Professor Orfan Kalik from Cardiff Law School?
Yes.
Is professor of public international and EU laws, so he's a man to my heart. He's had a very interesting career in both public international and EU law, and has been working for the Cardiff Law School since 1996 and really worked his way up from lecturer all the way to professor. Today he's going to talk to us about the EU and the European Social Charter. And I'm excited because I hope that he will also sort of bring his public international law understanding into his presentation. Welcome to Cambridge.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much for inviting me, and it's a pleasure and an honour to be here. I plan to talk for about 20 or 25 minutes, and if I plan to talk for 20 minutes, I'll probably speak for half an hour. So that'll just give us some time for discussion. I should very much emphasise that this is a work in progress, and I can see that there's a much larger project that this may evolve into over time. I should emphasise at the start that I'm not an EU social rights lawyer and employment lawyer, as was pointed out. I'm primarily a general EU lawyer and also a public international lawyer. So what I aim to do for the next 20 or so minutes is I want to make some introductory comments and set out some key themes. And then I will briefly discuss in outline a little something about the European Social Charter system, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, what it is and how it's enforced. And I will then talk about how it relates to EU law from the EU law perspective. And I think the real crux of my paper is I will talk about how EU law is being considered by the organs of the European Social Charter and how they've approached EU law. And I really want to reflect upon some really very interesting developments which are taking place currently, which may have some repercussions. Whether they are serious or not will remain to be seen. But I suppose before I do all of that, is that the very first question is, why am I discussing the issue? Well, when Professor Barnard very kindly invited me to come, I was at the time actually reading the documentation from the Council of Europe, looking at the EU's attempt to accede to the European Convention on Human Rights. And I had also just finished some work where I'd been looking at the European Union becoming a party to the UN's Convention for People with Disabilities. Where there was an issue of competence, and actually the EU had managed to negotiate itself as a party to that treaty. And I do have an established interest in the protection of economic and social rights as a public international lawyer. And so for me it was very much a natural fit to look at how the European Union relates to the protection of economic and social rights in international law. Having suggested a topic, I then thought I'd better do some research and have a look, see what's been written on this. And there's actually a wonderful piece written by Olivier de Schutterd some years back, where he'd argued that actually all of Europe should anchor its social rights protection according to the standards set by the European Social Charter. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that, but much has happened since then. And actually, you can see the dynamics have changed in very subtle but sort of also quite flagrant ways as well. And I really want to reflect upon some of those. And I suppose it's essentially, I've always been rather frustrated, if I can put it in those terms, when I wear my EU law hat, at the lack of real discussion amongst EU lawyers when they look at the protection of economic and social rights. There is fabulous discussion out there, absolutely wonderful, but it comes from an EU law perspective when you look at employment rights or social rights, and it doesn't tend to look at or in fact refer to the international standards which exist. There's occasional reference to ILO and the work of the ILO and the committee of experts in the ILO, but really there's very little with regard to the fabulous work of the Committee on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights or indeed the European Social Charter. So that's really where I was coming from. Now, I think I just want to go back a little bit, if I may, and just think a little bit about a couple of things which have happened in the past. Now, I want to start with Opinion 2 of 94. Now, everyone really knows that Opinion 2 of 94 was in many senses quite a serious attempt to move the discussion forward with regard to the European Union as it is now, but with regard to the European community as it was at the time, trying to accede to the European Convention. But I think even if you look back to Opinion 2 of 94, it's quite clear that the question was framed solely with regard to accession to the European Convention and not to the European Social Charter. And as everyone knows, at the moment, accession discussions to the Convention are bogged down in very difficult political and legal issues, but although they're at a very advanced stage. Those very difficult issues were always going to be inevitable. And that's not just the political intransigence of the Russians or the Turks or other non-EU member states. And those sorts of problems are, of course, much more difficult to overcome at the UN level. But certainly at the Council of Europe level, you would think they can be overcome. Now, just going back to Opinion 2 of 94, I do wonder why, when the question was framed, did they only refer to accession to the European Convention and not to accession to the European Social Charter? Because in many senses, although there would still, of course, have to be a treaty amendment, as the court opined at the time, the Union actually had fairly substantial competence in economic and social rights matters. So if there was a natural fit for a regional human rights treaty, it actually was to the European Social Charter, as opposed to the European Convention on Human Rights. Of course, the European Court of Justice, it's often been suggested, had other reasons for rejecting that competence existed to accede to the European Convention. But certainly it's true that there was a perfectly good case to be made that the European Union should consider accession to the European Social Charter, and does it have competence to that end? So it's always been apparent to me that accession to the Social Charter is in many senses a fairly obvious and natural fit for the Union. It's currently open to states, but I am quite confident that if you wanted an amending protocol within the Council of Europe to the effect to allow the Union to accede in areas within its competence, that wouldn't be particularly difficult to negotiate. At the UN level, if under the Disability Rights Convention, regional international organisations can accede, that of course has been done during negotiation of the treaty. At the Council of Europe level, I think it would be much more straightforward, or in relative terms in any case. All member states of the Union are party to the European Social Charter in one form or another. I will explain that in a moment. Also, it's important to note that in terms of natural fit, the European Social Charter is, of course, a regional treaty. And if you look consistently over the years from 1961 onwards, member states of the European, what is now the European Union, have formed approximately a two-third majority of membership of the Social Charter. And thus, standards of protection are more likely to be closely mapped to the situation within the Union's member states. Thirdly, in terms of natural fit, as I've already mentioned, the Union has extensive competence in a number of areas which are regulated by the Social Charter. Fourthly, just moving away slightly from these sorts of types of issues, it's certainly true to say that all Union member states are very keen advocates, rhetorically at least, of the idea that all rights, be they economic, social, cultural, civil or political, are, as the mantra goes, interdivisible, interdependent and interrelated. Although, of course, it's well known that certain member states, and this one is one of them, are less keen on economic and social rights as rights in the strict sense. Although I should actually point out that if you read the statements made by representatives from the United Kingdom when they are before UN committees concerned with the protection of economic and social rights, they've actually shown some very subtle but marked changes of approach over recent years as to their approach towards economic and social rights, their views on justiciability, and also the nature of economic and social rights. It's a much more accepting approach to economic and social rights at the UN level. I haven't really been able to discern if they've made the same moves at the Union level. I'm not certain, but I think if you look at the EU Charter and the opt-outs, that would suggest probably not. Fifthly, I think it's probably worth stressing, in terms of natural fit, that while the Union's accession to the European Convention is important for various reasons, be it legitimacy for the project, be it about establishing minimum standards of conduct, and having an external independent adjudicating body to ensure compliance. There are, speaking as the international human rights, with the international human rights law hat on now, there are, broadly speaking, relatively few circumstances when union institutions or member states, when implementing EU law, are likely to breach fundamental civil and political rights as protected by the convention system. In that sense, if you look at the European Court of Human Rights decision, the Bosphorus case, whether you consider it to be rightly or wrongly decided, it did set out that there are that due to measures adopted by the Union, the jurisprudence of the court, there is a presumption, albeit a rebuttable one, that union activities comply with and protect civil and political rights to a standard which is akin to that required by the convention system. I would actually, while I'm talking about the international treaties, point you to an opinion of the Human Rights Committee, which operates under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, in the so-called suspected Belgian terrorist cases, which involved issues very similar to those as in Bosphorus and also in the Caddy case, where the Human Rights Committee found Belgium to be in breach of its covenant obligations, where it was implementing UN Security Council resolutions implemented through EU regulations concerning sanctions against an individual. And certainly the covenant was interpreted by the Human Rights Committee, and when the Human Rights Committee looked at EU law, they certainly did not consider there to be any sort of rebuttable presumption with regard to standards of human rights protection. So there is, in a global document, of course, that's perfectly sensible. So just because the European Court has said they have a certain standard in human rights terms which is acceptable, doesn't mean to say other human rights treaty bodies have accepted that to be the case. Just going back to Caddy, which I alluded to, I think it depends which perspective you come from, whether you come from that of as an EU lawyer or whether you come as a public international lawyer, to the extent, of course, those two are mutually exclusive. While you can strongly contest the foundations of the court's approach in Caddy and the basis upon which rights are protected, I think the decision does lend further credence to the argument that the union system and the European Court protect civil and political rights in a broadly acceptable way. So that does raise the fundamental question. If you have the European Social Charter as a regional treaty, it protects rights which all member states have accepted, the union has extensive competence in the area, and the union protects civil and political rights in a way which is considered more or less acceptable, why does the union not consider accession to the European Social Charter? And if we are perfectly candid and frank, EU accession to the European Social Charter is not currently a serious topic for discussion within EU institutions. There are repeated calls for it by the European Trade Union Congress. There have been calls over a long period of time by the European Parliament, and indeed there have been calls from from individuals associated with the European Social Charter itself, but it's not likely to happen anytime soon. Well, I would venture an answer as to why the European Union doesn't seriously consider accession to the European Social Charter, and it's this: that in many respects, external adjudication of the standard to which the union seeks to protect economic and social rights will expose the union's Achilles heel when it comes to protecting rights. Civil and political rights in this sense are quite distinct, and a distinction can be drawn from economic and social rights. I mean, it is well known amongst observers of the European Union, and it's a widely held view, that the balance the union strikes between fundamental rights and market freedoms is not ideal from the perspective of rights protection, even if it works from the court's perspective of the functioning of the internal market. The Laval and Viking cases, which I'll come back to, and which I know have been discussed in great detail in this forum previously, are good examples of this when it comes to the protection of economic and social rights. And to be rather blunt about it, the European Union is at best indifferent and really at worst giving a cold shoulder to the European Social Charter and the work of the European Committee on Social Rights who interpret it. And I think that cold shoulder has repercussions. I'll come back to this, but the European Committee on Social Rights, who interpret the European Social Charter, have not taken, I suppose, the slur against them lightly, and they have reacted accordingly. Now, just a couple of other comments, if I may, before I come back to the European Social Charter and how it functions. I think it's worth pointing a few things out, in particular from an international law perspective. When you look at relations between international courts and tribunals as they exist at the international and, of course, the regional level, there is, of course, a degree of comity between them and how they relate to one another. And there is also, of course, informally at least, a pecking order of some sort. In terms of regional courts and tribunals in sort of Western Europe, whether it's been the European Court of Justice or the European Court of Human Rights, at the top of that order for EU member states, is that open to discussion? But if you just going back to opinion 2 of 94, which I mentioned before, it's certainly possible to read that opinion by the European Court of Justice so as to highlight that the then judges at the ECJ didn't wish to be subservient to the European Court and its judges. Post-accession, assuming accession does and will take place, the European Court will be, for those union matters, referred to it in many senses the final arbiter. But when it comes to European courts and tribunals, the European Committee on Social Rights and its work in interpreting the European Social Charter is actually quite some way down that pecking order. I don't think it's any great secret that members of the European Court of Justice don't consider the European Committee on Social Rights to be particularly important. That doesn't mean, however, that as far as states are concerned, that the treaty obligations they've undertaken under the European Social Charter are legally speaking less binding. I mean, the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties doesn't draw those sorts of distinctions. It draws distinctions between obligations and norms which are considered to be jus cogens, but actually a legally binding obligation under one treaty is of the same normative status as that under another. Although there are arguments in international law literature that human rights treaties should be of a higher normative status, I don't think that's widely accepted in general terms, although certain rights may be considered to be more normative than others. But there is a legal reality. EU law is directly effective, or certainly is capable of direct effect. It is supreme, and it is enforceable before the European Court of Justice and domestic courts in a way that almost all other treaty obligations, let alone human rights treaties, simply are not. Failure to comply with EU law opens states up to liability in ways that human rights treaties simply cannot match. That also has repercussions, both legal and political, for states. I think it's fair to say that if you observe the work of the European Committee of Social Rights over a number of years, they're perfectly aware of that reality, that EU law has a special status within the member states that they simply cannot, and they cannot have. And I think if you look at that approach, it's clear that their approach to how they map EU standards to the provisions of the European Social Charter has changed. And I would suggest that if you go back maybe 20, 25 years and look at the conclusions of the European Committee on Social Rights, there was a very substantial degree of deference born of both political and legal reality in relation to EU standards. And I would suggest that if you look at it now, they have adopted a much more assertive approach. I won't go so far as to say it's confrontational just yet, but it's certainly much more assertive. And I would suggest that there is a very clear agenda behind taking such an assertive approach. Now, precisely what I think that might be is something I will come back to. But before I do so, I really should say something about the European Social Charter, what it is and where it comes from and all those sorts of things, and give you an indication of how it relates to the Union. I'll be very brief in my discussion of the Charter. I mean, the original version of the Charter, as you will know, was adopted in 1961. And it is a very outdated document. A number of further rights were added by additional protocol in 1988. And in 1996, a more thoroughgoing revision of the Charter was undertaken when many existing rights were substantially amended and updated and a number of new rights added. And this led to the adoption of a new treaty, the revised European Social Charter of 1996. In terms of EU member states, all are party to the European Social Charter in one form or another. Five are party to the 1961 Charter only. They are Germany, Latvia, Luxembourg, Poland, and the United Kingdom. Four are party to the 1961 Charter and the 1988 Additional Protocol. They are the Czech Republic, Denmark, Greece, and Spain. And the other 18 are parties to the 1996 revised European Social Charter. So there's clearly a disparity there as to which treaty obligations have been accepted. The Charter provides for two forms of machinery. One is the classic standard UN mechanism of a reporting system, which is obligatory for all states and exists under all forms of the Charter. The second compliance mechanism is a system of collective complaints. So it's a petition system. And this was introduced in 1995, and it is optional. 15 state parties have ratified the Collective Complaints Protocol. 14 of those are EU member states. The 15th is Norway. The 14 include France, Italy, Greece, Sweden, Finland, Belgium, Portugal. There are others. And it is that Collective Complaints Protocol which, for our purposes at least, has fundamentally and more generally changed the dynamic of the system. The Charter is interpreted by the European Committee of Social Rights, which I've mentioned, and it's composed of 15 independent experts. At the time of, at this current moment in time, 13 of those 15 members come from EU member states. 9 are from what I would call the older member states. 4 are from the post-2005 member states. The other two members are Russian and Turkish, and that dynamic should not be ignored. The European Social Charter plays a major role in reporting and the Collective Complaints Protocol, and I think it's important to stress that it is subordinate to the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe. Although legally speaking, it is the only body which is authoritative to interpret the European Social Charter, it's only the Committee of Ministers which is competent to make recommendations to states. It is the findings of the European Committee on Social Rights, its conclusions, its findings in collective complaints, which form its jurisprudence. Just to draw an analogy again with UN human rights treaty bodies, the Committee on Social Rights does not produce what are known as general comments in UN human rights treaty bodies, but it has, since the late 1990s at least, started to publish a digest of its case law. But I think essentially for the researcher interested in the social charter, you have to look for the conclusions and you have to look at the individual national reports and you have to look at the collective complaints to get a real idea of how rights are being interpreted. In terms of substantive rights, both the original 1961 charter and the revised charter make a distinction between core and non-core rights. Now, in the original charter, there are 7 core rights, including the right to form trade unions, employers' associations, and to bargain collectively, all of which are relevant to EU law, and very importantly, for the purpose of EU law, an obligation to protect migrant workers. The revised charter adds a number of core rights, in particular for our purposes, the right to equal opportunities in treatment and employment. You'll very quickly see the trend here. The second category of rights, the non-core rights, are areas such as the rights to just conditions of work, safe and healthy working conditions, fair remuneration, and so forth. And the additional protocol adds further rights, which include, for our purposes, the rights to equal opportunities and equal treatment, rights of workers to be informed and consulted in the workplace, rights of workers to determine the improvement of working conditions. And there are also non-core rights, which include the rights to protection in case of termination of employment, protection of workers' rights and claims of employer insolvency, dignity at work, equal opportunities and treatment of workers, representation in the workplace, information and consultation and collective redundancy procedures. All of these are areas where there is substantive EU competence, where the Union has adopted very substantial numbers of directives, which sort of impose obligations upon member states. Now, the European Social Charter is, unlike UN treaty bodies in one important respect when it comes to the protection of economic and social rights, in that its obligations are not progressive. They are to be implemented, they are not to be implemented gradually, they are of immediate effect. I think that's a very important distinction to bear in mind. What the Social Charter does share with a number most other treaties concerned with economic and social rights is that the treaty provisions themselves are framed in really rather vague language. Having said that, those which are concerned with employment rights in particular are drafted in sufficiently precise terms to be judicially enforceable. I don't think there's any real doubt about the justiciability of those rights, which is where often the discussion about economic and social rights tends to go. So I think it's very important to bear in mind that, you know, the Social Charter contains rights which are judicially enforceable. They are relatively clear and precise in some respects, although not in all. The other thing which is very important to bear in mind is that the European Social Charter doesn't apply to everyone within a state's jurisdiction, which is the case under the European Convention. It only applies to those who are lawfully in a state and that individual is from another contracting state party. Now, in that sense, being a member of the European Union makes a substantial difference because you must extend the most favourable treatment to all nationals of other contracting states. So if you are awarding rights to EU nationals under EU law, you must also afford those rights to other nationals of other contracting states, even if they are outside the Union. Now, as I've said, it is very obvious that there is a substantial overlap between the rights protected under the terms of the European Social Charter and the European Union's competences in social policy. So the first question really is what role, if any, from the perspective of the Union, does the European Social Charter and its various manifestations play in Union law? I don't really have time to go through them in detail, but broadly speaking, I think you can identify five ways in which it does play a role. The first is in reference to is referenced in the treaties. At different times through the Single European Act, the Maastricht Treaty, Amsterdam, etc., reference has been made to the European Social Charter in different places. Once in a while it's been taken out, but then later reintroduced. The Single European Act 1986, for example, in its preamble notes, makes reference to the European Social Charter. It makes reference to the European Social Charter. At Amsterdam, there's reference to the European Social Charter, but also, very importantly, reference to the 1989 Community Charter of Fundamental Social Rights of Workers. And actually, the 1989 Community Charter of the Fundamental Social Rights of Workers can be seen as a competing document to the additional protocol to the European Social Charter from 1988. I was saying to Professor Barnard before, I was a student of Professor David Harris's at the University of Nottingham, and Professor Harris was a member of the European Social, or was then the, what was then called the Committee of Independent Experts, but it's the European Committee on Social Rights. And he told us a story that he said when Margaret Thatcher came back to the UK in 1989, having negotiated an opt-out from the 1989 Community Charter of the Fundamental Social Rights of Workers, she was waving a document before the media to show how she'd secured the opt-out, and he said actually she was waving a copy of the 1961 European Social Charter and not the 1989 Community Charter. In any case, I think that's part of the nub of the issue. There is a competing document which has been adopted back in the late 1980s, which refers to social rights. In the post-Lisbon Treaty, there is reference to the European Social Charter in Title 10, on social policy. Article 151 makes specific reference to the European Social Charter, and then, of course, the 1989 Community Charter as well. Critically, there are some omissions. Article 6 of the Treaty on the European Union, which refers to fundamental rights, refers to the Charter of the Fundamental Rights of the European Union and the fact that the Union shall accede to the European Convention of human rights, and it also refers to the constitutional traditions common to the member states. There's absolutely nothing about economic and social rights there whatsoever. There's no reference to the European Social Charter at all. So there is reference in the treaties, although they are those references are uneven. There are references by the court as well in its jurisprudence when examining matters that come within this sphere. The Dominguez case is a relatively recent example of this. What's interesting to note is that whenever the court refers to the European Social Charter, it is almost always in passing, and almost always in the same breath as the Community Charter as well of 1989. Advocate generals do refer to it more often and more frequently, but usually if you find the references, they are tucked away in a footnote somewhere, and again, it's just a passing reference to its existence. The third possible way in which the Charter plays a role in EU law is through the Charter on Fundamental Rights, which, of course, as you know, is now legally binding and has the same status as the treaties. Now, this can be either through the work of the court or as a reference point for institutions in their actions, be they legislative or otherwise. The Charter does refer to the Convention and also the European Social Charter, and a very significant number of rights, freedoms, or principles as set out in the Charter draw from or overlap with provisions in the European Social Charter in its various manifestations, and this is recognised in the various documentation that accompanies the Charter. To take just a few examples, freedom to choose an occupation and right to engage in work, rights of the elderly, integration of persons with disabilities, workers' rights for information, collective bargaining, fair and just working conditions, all of these rights in the Charter are recognised as drawing upon or being closely related to the rights member states have undertaken as parties to the European Social Charter. But where the Charter is absolutely critical for our purposes is Articles 52 and Articles 53. Article 52.3 in particular sets out, insofar as the Charter contains rights which correspond to rights protected by the Convention, the scope of those rights will be the same as those laid down by the Convention. Well, what about the European Social Charter? You recognise both of these treaties are there. You recognise that rights in the Social Charter have influenced the EU's Charter, but when it comes to interpretation and consistency of interpretation, you only refer to one document, the European Convention, not the European Social Charter. Article 53 does refer to the level of protection, and nothing in the Charter shall be interpreted as restricting or adversely affecting human rights. And there was specific reference again to the European Convention on Human Rights. I think that's slightly disingenuous. There is special protection for the European Convention, but not for other treaty obligations. And certainly, due to the supremacy of EU law, they know it will trump other norms. So I think that reference is there as a saving clause, but I don't think it makes much difference when it comes to the European Social Charter. The fourth possible way in which the European Social Charter can play a role in EU law is where the institutions adopt legislation, this is secondary legislation in the field, and there have been directives which on occasion make passing reference to the Social Charter, in particular in their preambles, but there is nothing really substantive as far as I can recall. And the fifth and final one is really more of a potential avenue as opposed to one that I think has crystallised already, but I think post-accession it may become more significant. And I think you can see the influence of the European Social Charter in some respects in the jurisprudence of the European Court on Human Rights. Because the European Court does recognise to some extent that the European Social Charter is its counterpart in the field of economic and social rights. And I think very careful examination or creative reading, whichever you prefer, of the European Court's jurisprudence does highlight reference to an use of the European Social Charter in defining the scope of rights. This is certainly true when it comes to labour rights, as they are protected, to the extent they are protected at least, under the European Convention, especially when discriminatory treatment is involved. So if you look at Smith and Grady, which is about dismissal from the army solely on grounds of sexual orientation, in that case it's a breach of Article 8, and that could be an example, because you are looking at the protection of labour rights in that case. I think it's fair to say that when you look at labour rights, actually EU law may well provide an equally satisfactory remedy in some circumstances. I think that shouldn't be overlooked. So I think in summary, when it comes to the EU's looking at the European Social Charter, it's fair to say that it has not been central to the discussion on rights in the Union context. It plays a very marginalised role. I think it's fair to say that. Union law and standards, however, have been a very significant consideration in the work of the European Committee of Social Rights, not only with regard to the setting of standards, but also in other respects. And although it's not possible in the time I have to give you some detailed examples, I will try and give you a few where the actual issues are really coming to the fore. The first is the European Committee on Social Rights often refers to EU legislation in defining standards under the European Social Charter. As I've said before, this historically there's been a degree of deference there. And I think that is changing. I'll come back to that in a second if I may. But there are very significant numbers of examples, and I couldn't really conceptually distinguish them, where the European Committee on Social Rights very obviously looks at union law and says, right, these are the standards you must comply with as espoused in a particular directive. And it's not only in the case of setting standards which have already been established. When you look at the revision process of the European Social Charter and the revised European Social Charter in particular, you can see that when new rights were being drafted, they were often looking at what had happened at the European then community level to see what measures had been adopted, what new rights were being protected, and then making sure that they were being integrated into the revised European Social Charter. So, for example, the rights to just conditions of work, under Article 2 of the revised European Social Charter, make very clear reference to the minimum standards found in a community directive on employers' obligations to inform them of conditions applicable to their contract or the employment relationship. They're very clearly drawing in defining new treaty rights by very clear drawing upon EU directives. There are also examples before the European Committee on Social Rights when in complaints and also in the reporting process, the committee has found state parties in breach of their obligations under the Charter, but has advised them, which perhaps it shouldn't do, but has advised them, that if they were to properly give effect to an obligation under EU law, that would help them to ensure compliance with the Charter. Now, a good example of this is a collective complaint brought against Greece, and relatively recently by the International Federation of Human Rights, which concerned environmental protection and water pollution. And Greece was essentially advised that if it properly implemented a directive on, I think it was to do with water basins, if they properly implemented that directive, then they probably would have been in compliance with some aspects of the Charter that they were found to be non-compliant with. Now, as I said, there are many examples of this. Now, naturally, as a consequence of that, arises the second situation in which EU law makes an appearance in the European Social Charter institutions. Because, quite naturally, member states argue before the European Committee on Social Rights, because, as I said before, they have historically been rather deferential, we have dealt with this matter under an EU directive, and therefore the matter has been dealt with under that body of law. Thus, there is an assumption of conformity with the Charter. Or, actually, even if they don't go for conformity with the Charter, they say because it's been dealt with by under EU law, the EU is not a party to the Charter, therefore you have no competence to deal with this matter. Now, the European Committee of Social Rights hasn't shied away in recent years from confronting this. And as I said before, it has started to show a very clear assertiveness. And it actually hasn't shied away from scenarios where the European Court of Human Rights has displayed, in fact, greater restraint. When member states argue before the committee that it's not competent to consider EU law, they're absolutely correct. What the committee argues, which is equally correct, is that it's not competent to assess conformity of national situations with an EU directive, nor to assess compliance of a directive with the European Social Charter. That's absolutely correct. That must be right. But it has done two really quite interesting things. One is, it has made it extremely clear, and if I can just read this quote to you. It says, when preparing a text in question and transposing it into national law, member states must take full account of the commitments they have taken upon ratifying the European Social Charter. So basically what the European Social Charter is requiring of EU states is when they are negotiating EU directives, and then when they implement them into domestic law, they must have reference to EU to standards of the European Social Charter. So So in many senses, it's much like the EU obligation of loyal cooperation. In other contexts, when you are negotiating, you must pay attention to the standards you've accepted under the European Social Charter. Now, that is very interesting. Now there is, of course, a degree of wiggle room here, if I can use that term, because member states may implement a directive in particular incorrectly. But it's also true to say that if you look at some of the petitions which are coming before the Committee on Social Rights, some of the directives where there are complaints are being made about have been implemented for a number of years, in some cases up to 10 years. And if they had been incorrectly implemented, then you'd expect challenges either in domestic courts or before the European Court of Justice. Now, in this regard, the implementation of 2P has been subject to scrutiny by the European Committee on Social Rights. The EU's refugee directive is likely to be very closely analysed in the complaint which has been brought against Belgium, which concerns the treatment of unaccompanied minors. And there have certainly been cases, or petitions more accurately, where their complaints have highlighted very clearly the lack of protection afforded by EU law. Now, I'll give you two examples of this. Two petitions have been brought by a particular NGO, which is concerned with housing rights and expulsions. And it has brought petitions against Italy and France with regard to their collective expulsions of Roma from Bulgaria and Romania. And in particular, in the discussion with concerning France, France very heavily relied upon the EU citizenship directive and amongst a number of other EU measures. And France very correctly pointed out the European Commission was paying close attention to its compliance with EU law. And I think I'm correct in saying that to date, no enforcement action has been taken against France for those expulsions. The committee found France in flagrant violation of its obligations of the Charter and made specific mention of the fact that France was not, as far as it could see, in violation of its EU obligations, but clearly was in violation of its Charter obligations when it came to the expulsion of the Roma, and the situation was almost identical, the finding rather was almost identical in the petition concerning Italy. Now, there are, however, a number of other petitions which have arisen where the European Committee on Social Rights has had to confront head-on the relationship between EU law and the European Social Charter in its various manifestations. And in these complaints, the European Committee has taken a very clear and assertive approach. Not unnaturally, as I've said before, if one goes back in history, governments are relying upon compliance with the Charter by saying we comply with EU law, that's all we need to do, the standards are the same. The committee, however, has taken a very different approach. The committee has made it very clear that although the European Court of Human Rights in the Bosphorus case considers there is a presumption, albeit a rebuttable one, that EU law protects fundamental rights in a satisfactory manner, the European Committee of Social Rights has made it very clear there is no presumption whatsoever. And in actual fact, the European Committee of Social Rights doesn't seem to be able to bring itself to mention the Bosphorus case. It sort of just passes over, it just refers to it in sort of some sort of elusive terms, but actually mentions a much older case called Cotonou in France from 1996, which I think is probably closer to where it wants to go. If I can just quote to you the actual two key paragraphs of this complaint, it gives you a very clear indication of where the committee is coming from, and it actually also displays to you what I was suggesting to you before, that the committee has taken this slur that the European Union isn't interested in accession really to heart. And I'll just read these two paragraphs if I may. This is the European Committee when it's on social rights when it's considering compliance of EU law with the Social Charter. It says, the committee considers that neither the situation of social rights in the European Union legal order nor the process of elaboration of secondary legislation justifies a similar presumption, this is the Bosphorus presumption, even rebuttable, of conformity of legal texts of the European Union with the European Social Charter. So there's no rebuttable presumption that there is conformity. And here's the real sort of the heartache. Furthermore, the lack of political will of the European Union and its member states to consider at this stage acceding to the European Social Charter at the same time as the European Convention on Human Rights reinforces the committee's assessment. And therefore, the committee then sets out how it's going to pay very close attention to what happens. It may change its approach, it may go for the rebuttal presumption, but it's certainly not going to do so anytime soon. Now, my reading of the situation is this, that there's a very, very clear tactic at play here, and there's a very clear policy. And this is really an attempt to push the European Social Charter, if I can use this term, into the faces of the member states and in the faces of the European Union, and demand to have some attention paid to it. What's happened to the committee over a period of time is the committee has basically been ignored. And the committee has been ignored because it has showed a degree of deference to European Union standards. What's the situation now is, well, actually by taking a much more assertive approach, it's saying, well, actually, look, you have to pay attention to what we're doing. Now, I think there is some logic to this, and why the situation has arisen is precisely because the Collective Complaints Protocol has come into force. And the Collective Complaints Protocol has brought the issue of differing standards very, very much to light. And I think the tactic may be about to pay off, because there are two petitions, which I will mention very briefly, which are pending before the committee now. The first is a series of petitions, or there are at least five, possibly six or seven, being brought against Greece, challenging Greece's austerity measures. And in particular, what is being targeted are the Troika agreements, setting up financial support mechanisms for Greece, which have been negotiated between the European Commission, the ECB, and the IMF. Now, there's some discussion as to whether these are treaties, whether they're EU law, etc., that'll have to be settled, but they will raise difficult questions. The second petition, which has been lodged, is potentially far more confrontational. The Swedish trade unions have challenged the Swedish government's implementation of the ECJ's decision in the Laval case. And they've gone straight in for it. They've just said, right, this is not on. And they've argued very accurately and very correctly under the European Social Charter, restrictions on freedom of association and collective bargaining due to the need to promote market access is not an acceptable justification. So they've really gone for it. Viking Laval, as you all know, and as I mentioned before, were not considered through a human rights prism whatsoever. And Sweden is in a rather tricky situation here. There may be some room about how Sweden has implemented the ECJ's decision. Sweden is quite clear that it's done it as well as it possibly can. So you can see that the European Committee on Social Rights, by taking the approach it has, actually will now compel the Union to consider what's going on in that committee. And in many senses, it'll compel it to consider the situation. It also will compel member states to make clear choices about what they are going to do. As I said, I think in the terms of pecking order, the European Social Charter is way down the pecking order, but of course it does raise very important issues. And I will stop there.